The Brazilian government allows two Iranian warships to dock in Rio de Janeiro, defying pressure from the United States to bar them. The Kremlin says Russia will not resume participation in the New START nuclear arms reduction treaty until Washington listens to Moscow's position. Also ahead, Beijing strongly condemns US sanctions against Chinese companies for Russia-related reasons, vowing to take resolute countermeasures. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, two Iranian Navy ships have docked in Rio de Janeiro despite US pressure to bar them. The Macron and Denner Navy vessels arrived in Brazilian waters on Sunday morning after the government granted them permission. The two vessels left Iran's southern waters in early fall with the purpose of sailing around the world. They are expected to break the record for the distance an Iranian flotilla has covered in international waters. The two ships have been sanctioned by the U.S. Earlier this month, the U.S. ambassador to Brazil urged the government of President Lula da Silva not to allow them to dock. During his previous presidential terms, Lula ramped up diplomatic engagements with Iran as part of his attempts to bolster Brazil's international standing. Tehran has hosted the first memorial of Martyrs of Resistance Media, entitled Narrators of Resistance. In an address to the event, head of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting, Peyman Jebeli, said resistance is not a cost, it is an investment. Our very own correspondent, Saman Kajuri, reports.
The first memorial of Martyrs of Resistance Media, entitled Narrators of Resistance, has been held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The families of media martyrs from Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Lebanon attended the event. Addressing the ceremony, the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Quds Force, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, praised the Martyrs of Resistance Media as a treasure which must be well invested.
The media presence of our martyrs makes them convey the sublime values that led them to achieve the goal of martyrdom. The global arrogance led by the US promotes that those who own money and the biggest weapons are to emerge victorious in wars. However, despite its limited capabilities, the media of the resistance front succeeded in conveying the voice of truth.
Moreover, speaking at the event, head of the IRIB, Dr. Jebeli, honored the media martyrs on the resistance front.
In hard war, the enemy seeks to destroy our fortifications and force us to retreat from one place to another. But in soft war, the enemy does not use weapons, bombardment, and physically does not seek to push us back from one area to another, but seeks to mislead us, change our thinking, distort reality, and take us away from the straight path. We proudly pay for our resistance, but I would like to say that resistance not only costs nothing, but is a total investment. The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance.
The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance. Journalists of resistance media, as the narrators of resistance and truth, shed light on the realities on the ground in conflict zones, the realities which have been repeatedly ignored by mainstream media outlets of the West, led by the United States. Saman Kujurib, Tehran.
Egypt's foreign minister has paid an official visit to the Syrian capital, Damascus, where he held talks with top officials over the repercussions of the earthquakes, as well as bilateral relations. Mohammed Ali has more on that.
Egypt's foreign minister Sameh Shoukry has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In the meeting, the top diplomat conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's message of solidarity to Assad and all Syrians affected by the recent earthquakes. He also expressed Cairo's keenness on bolstering historic relations between Syria and Egypt, as well as boosting joint cooperation. Assad, for his part, thanked Egypt for sending humanitarian assistance, asserting that improving bilateral ties among Arab states constitute the foundation for improving the situation in general in the Arab world. Shukri stressed that Egypt-Syria relations are a basic factor in the security of Arab countries. He also reiterated his country's support for Syria.
Egypt has offered so far 1,500 tons of assistance and will continue to provide all humanitarian assistance needed. Relations between both nations are strong. Egypt supports Syria in facing challenges. We hope Syria overcomes the repercussions of the earthquakes as soon as possible.
Shukri also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, in which Faisal al-Maqdad briefed him on the steps taken by the Syrian government for helping Syrians affected by the earthquakes. Al-Maqdad also thanked Egypt for its unwavering aid to Syrians since day one of the earthquakes.
We welcome Egypt's foreign minister, who is visiting his home, people and country. His talks with President Assad focused on the results of the earthquakes and the historic relations between both countries. Egypt played a significant role in assisting Syrians following the earthquakes.
The visit comes a day after a historic trip by several senior lawmakers of Arab parliaments to Damascus, who affirmed they will push their governments for restoring relations with Syria. That's amid an increase in such moves by Arab states. This is the first visit for an Egyptian foreign minister to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. It's a clear indication of Egypt's serious intention to gradually restore normal ties with the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Well, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnea talks about how Syria and the Syrian people have been neglected, especially in the wake of the devastating earthquake.
What they're trying to say to Syria, we're coming to see you, but we still don't have the full support to restart the reconstruction. Syria needs between $500 and $800 billion to be reconstructed. The Arab didn't invest anything. It's only a bit shy Russian support on the military side, but a lot of Iranian support. Every 15 days, there is a tanker of oil. There is a humanitarian support that's coming through the border on a very regular basis. Where are the Arabs and the Gulf-rich countries? They don't dare to support Syria because Syria is still under the sanctions, still under Caesar sanctions, and the Americans are shying away their interest in Syria, although they are present in stealing the Syrian oil and the Syrian food basket. If they really want to support Syria, they just can leave and end their occupation and allow the Syrian to benefit from their own natural resources. So the return of the Arab is really a visit of a foreign minister is not really a big event if it is not followed by a serious plan of reconstructing Syria.
Turning elsewhere, the United Nations has raised around $1.2 billion, or a quarter of the aid it had sought for war-ravaged Yemen. The UN had appealed for $4.3 billion from donors at a pledging conference in Geneva. The Norwegian Refugee Council's Yemen chief described the aid as woefully inadequate. She said it gives the signal that some humans are less valuable than others. The UN has described the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. It says nearly 22 million people, or two-thirds of Yemen's population, need humanitarian assistance this year. The impoverished country has been under a devastating blockade since Saudi Arabia and its allies launched the war against it in 2015. Russia says it will not rejoin a key nuclear arms reduction treaty until the West changes its attitude towards Moscow. The Kremlin spokesman said NATO has now turned into Russia's enemy by arming Ukraine. Dmitry Peskov added that the security of one country cannot be ensured at the expense of the security of another. Last week, President Vladimir Putin announced Russia's decision to suspend participation in the New START treaty. He cited Washington's failure to keep its end of the bargain and its deepening involvement in the Ukraine war. The U.S. called the move deeply unfortunate and irresponsible. The New START treaty was signed between the U.S. and Russia in 2010. It puts a limit on nuclear devices and the means of their delivery. China has slammed the flight of a U.S. surveillance plane through the Taiwan Strait. The Chinese army says the U.S. is interfering with regional affairs and endangering peace and stability in the sensitive waterway. It said Chinese troops are on high alert and will resolutely defend the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The U.S. Navy says the aircraft had flown in international airspace. It says the U.S. will continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows, including within the Taiwan Strait. China regards Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against U.S. military presence in the region and ties with Taipei. Meanwhile, China has slammed the U.S. for imposing, quote, illegal sanctions against its companies over alleged support for Russia in the Ukraine war.
The actions of the United States have no basis in international law at all, nor are they authorized by the UN Security Council. They are typical illegal unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction which seriously damage China's interest. China is strongly dissatisfied and firmly opposed to this and has lodged stern representation with the U.S.
Mao also reviled the resolute countermeasures by China. She said the sanctions show U.S. hegemony and double standards. The spokesperson added that the U.S. must stop spreading disinformation and withdraw sanctions on Chinese companies. The U.S. has imposed sanctions on two Chinese satellite firms for allegedly providing imagery and intelligence to the Russian army. In recent weeks, the U.S. has repeatedly accused China of mulling military support for Russia. Beijing has denied the claims and in turn accused Washington of fueling the flames of war by arming Ukraine. Now, Russia says the conditions are currently not in place to peacefully resolve the war in Ukraine after the Chinese proposal for a political settlement. The Kremlin says it has paid, quote, a lot of attention to the plan by its Chinese friends. Last week, Beijing released a 12-point paper calling for a comprehensive ceasefire, peace talks, and respect for all countries' territorial sovereignty. China also demanded an end to unilateral sanctions on Russia and criticized NATO expansion. Russia says any settlement of the conflict needs to recognize its control over the four Ukrainian regions it annexed last year. It also wants Ukraine to renounce its bid to join NATO. Kiev, meanwhile, says it's open to parts of the Chinese plan, but has stressed that it will not agree to any peace without the return of all its territory. Turning elsewhere, Britain and the European Union have proclaimed what they call a new chapter in post-Brexit relations after securing a deal to regulate trade in Northern Ireland. British Premier Rishi Sunak considers the deal as a turning point for the people of Northern Ireland. Speaking at a news conference with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, Sunak said this is the beginning of a new chapter in UK-EU relationship. Von der Leyen agreed it marks a new chapter after more than a year of fraught talks. Sunak claims the deal dismantles a de facto customs border that had sprung up in the Irish Sea, both to protect the EU single market and a hard-won peace in Northern Ireland agreed 25 years ago. The UK government must now sell the deal to pro-British parties in Northern Ireland and to staunch supporters of Brexit in the Conservative Party. Sunak said the deal would be submitted to a vote in the UK Parliament at an appropriate time. Meanwhile, Britain's major supermarket groups have been called in by the government to discuss the country's shortage that's entered a third week. The Food and Farming Minister will meet bosses of Britain's major grocers later today. Several supermarket groups have imposed customer purchase limits on tomatoes, cucumbers, and peppers. That after supplies across the supermarket sector were hit by disrupted harvests in southern Europe and North Africa due to unseasonable weather. The crisis has been exacerbated by less winter production in greenhouses in Britain and the Netherlands because of high energy costs.
Tomatoes, one of your five a day. Supermarket giants in the UK are now only allowing three of these and other salad ingredients to their customers. And where there is availability, you'll have to pay a premium, especially when it comes to out-of-season fresh produce. Here is why.
Starting with climate change, 2022 was the second hottest year in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem with supplying countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the UK has its own well-established food industry. One important component of it, greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay barren.
There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive. And the problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing. So it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets. And so rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all.
And the UK faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and veg come from the European Union. The country's exit from the bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods.
Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. More bureaucracy, and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profits, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that.
The solution, food-producing organisations say, is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high-carbon fertilizers with low-carbon alternatives, or investing more in soil-free indoor growing techniques, such as vertical farming. Saeed Purza, London.
That brings an end to the International Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces have recently killed at least 10 Palestinians in the West Bank raid. The Palestinian Health Ministry reports at least 102 people were injured, including three journalists. Last year was the deadliest year in the West Bank since 2006, with 171 Palestinians, including 30 children, killed by Israeli regime forces. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. truth out, wrote in this regard, a child and two elderly people were among at least 10 Palestinians who were killed recently by the Zionist regime military forces conducting a raid in the West Bank city of Nablus. The attack brings the number of Palestinians killed in the occupied territories by the Zionist regime forces to 61 since the beginning of the year 2023, a rate of more than one per day, the website of Middle East Eye reported. Three children have been killed, according to this website. The IDF drove dozens of armored vehicles into the Nablus city center at 10 a.m. and blocked off all entrances to the city as the Zionist regime forces surrounded a building where two members of the Lion's Den, a local Palestinian resistance group, were believed to be. The Zionist regime's military also fired tear gas, injuring a number of women and children who ambulances were blocked from reaching, an eyewitness named Nabila Soleiman told Middle East Eye. Soleiman was walking through a market with her daughter when the raid began, Soleiman told the website of Middle East Eye. It was very scary. We could hear the sounds of explosions and people screaming in the street, and many of us started crying and praying to God to protect the city and its residents. CCTV footage showed at least two unarmed men being shot as they ran away from the Zionist regime forces. Political analyst Omar Badar said, Nablus is a Palestinian city in the occupied land that Israel has no right to rule or operate in. This is murderous aggression, pure and simple. The Palestinian Health Ministry told Al Jazeera that at least 102 people were injured in the attack, including 82 who were hit by live ammunition and 6 who were in critical condition. Al Jazeera reported that 3 journalists were among the wounded. One morning, so much pain and death, said Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Abraham Gottman. At least 6 Palestinians killed by the Zionist regime forces in Nablus, including a 72-year-old man. Over 70 people were injured by bullets and tear gas. Al Jazeera reports that 3 of the wounded are journalists. One morning, so much pain and death. The deadly raid came less than a month after 10 Palestinians, including an elderly woman, were killed by an IDF attack on a refugee camp in the West Bank city of Jenin. The Palestinian resistance movement is growing in both cities. Palestinian journalist Mariam Barghouti told Al Jazeera, officials announced a general strike in Nablus and Ramallah in response to the attack. We are hearing stories that Israeli regime forces were shooting at the neighbors, people in their houses, people going about their daily lives, reported Neda Ibrahim at Al Jazeera, adding, Palestinians say Israel is acting this way because it is not being held accountable and has a free hand in killing Palestinians. Last year was the deadliest year in the West Bank since 2006, with 171 Palestinians, including 30 children, killed by the Zionist regime forces. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported, in light of the Zionist regime's recent military attacks, an escalation of widespread and systematic violations against the Palestinian people, 35 Palestinian civil society organizations sent a letter to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, Karim Khan, requesting him to expedite the investigation into the situation in Palestine and urgently issue a preventive statement to deter Israeli regime forces from committing more crimes against Palestinians. The letter comes following the Zionist regime occupying forces, IOF vicious military attacks on Jenin, the Akbat Jabar refugee camps, and Nablus City, notably on January 26, February 6, and February 22, respectively, the high rise in the number of Palestinians killed, and the imposition of punitive measures. Alarmingly, since the beginning of this year, and as of the morning of February 23, 2023, the IOF and Zionist settlers killed 63 Palestinians throughout the occupied Palestinian territory. In addition to the dangerous escalation of violations against Palestinians at very high speed, the letter alarms the prosecutor to the Israeli regime authorities' policy of withholding Palestinian bodies and illegally transferring those injured to Israeli hospitals within the green line upon arresting them, which makes it difficult to conclusively assert the exact number of Palestinians killed by IOF and Zionist settlers, such as the case with the Zionist regime military attack against Akbat Jabar refugee camp on February 6th. The joint letter urges the prosecutor to take immediate and meaningful action as to permitted by his mandate under the Rome Statute to contribute to the deterrence and prevention of further deprivation of lives and commission of more crimes by the Zionist regime authorities, as well as to investigate and prosecute the crimes of inter alia, willful killing, crimes committed against children, the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution, and the war crime of civilian population transfer in. Specifically, the letter requests the prosecutor to issue a preventive statement as per the office of the prosecutor's previous practice to crucially reflect and maintain the court's commitment to ending the cycle of impunity and delivering justice to Palestinian victims who have been suffering under the Zionist regime, settler colonial and apartheid regime.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and let us enlighten our minds and souls with an admonishment from the Prophet's fourth infallible heir, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. O son of Adam, you are on the right as long as you are admonished by your own self. Care very much for maintaining judgment with yourself, and betake fear as your slogan and caution as your garment. O son of Adam, you will unquestionably be dead, resurrected, and standing before your Lord the Majestic. You should prepare an answer for all that.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadarbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Journey Towards Perfection. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of Journey Towards Perfection in the Islamic lifestyle. What we talk about, journey towards perfection, it is known as a practice in a way that we want to gain reformation in a religious matter, which is generally known in Persian as Sayru Suluk, or we cannot say it is becoming a monk, but obviously it is a journey towards the self-reformation. And it is better to say this journey towards the self-reformation, which has been also mentioned in the books of the practical books of mysticism, which is known as Irfan-e Amali. So therefore, it is necessary that every single Muslim goes towards this. Why? Because he needs to reach to the level where he has reformed himself. And since Allah has created him potentially perfect, he has to practically become perfect. Therefore, it is necessary in the Islamic lifestyle that we must know about the halal and haram. We must know about the good and evil. And after that, must go towards the self-reformation or self-purification through the ascesis, which is known as Riyadh, basically. So therefore, it is necessary that in the Islamic lifestyle, we also have this important part of this important part in our life, so that when we are performing things, we do in line with the teachings that are being set by the Quran or the mystics who have gone through this path, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of journey towards perfection in the Islamic lifestyle. Now, we said that this means that we must go towards a journey, we must practice in order to reach to the spiritual peace. And for that, We can see that in the world, there are some people who practice yoga, who practice different things. There are the discussions of black magic as Kabbalah in the Judaism, and in other religions we see different things. But none of them is taking human beings towards the spiritual peace, towards the perfection. Whereas Islam takes the human beings towards the perfection. The things that we do, we perform it with the intention of qurbatan ilallah, in order to get the nearness of God, nearness of Allah. And when we perform such things, there we are very much careful that we do not disobey Allah. And this is also one of the ways of performing the journey towards the perfection, or journey towards the purification. And this journey will take us to a level where Allah wants us to be, and that is the level of purified people. And that's why we see that Allah has made Ahlul Bayt and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his holy progeny as a role model for us, so that when we go towards this path, we get this nearness. And obviously, generally, the things that are said to perform is the love of God, the saying of the dhikr, having the tawassul, to wake up in the night, to avoid the doubts, to avoid the makruhat, unwanted things, and to perform the mustahabat and wajibat. So these are the ways in which we can, inshallah, get to the perfection. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
July 12, 2022. A young man loses his temper in a court in Tehran. It's the trial of Jamshid Sharmat, the ringleader of the so-called Kingdom Assembly of Iran, also known as Tondar, a terrorist group with the blood of innocent citizens on its hands. The group also seeks the downfall of the Islamic Republic and the restoration of the ousted monarchy at any cost. Like many other terrorist opposition groups, Tondar is located in the United States. It has its own TV channel and radio station in Los Angeles, used mainly for stirring up hatred. The group also runs a website that includes dangerous contents, such as user manuals in Farsi for making improvised explosive devices. It collects funds for its terrorist activities through its Bank of America account. And although Interpol has issued arrest warrants for several of the group's senior members, they continue to live with impunity in Los Angeles and London, as well as some other Western capitals. In fact, the group enjoys widespread support from the CIA and the FBI. By their own admission, Tondar has launched dozens of terrorist attacks and killed tens of civilians in Iran. In 2006, for example, the group succeeded in an explosion of Sivan Dam in Fars province. In 2009, it carried out an improvised bomb attack on the mausoleum of Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic. In 2010, the group admitted instigating unrest after the June 12 presidential elections. And again the same year, the European branch of Tundar claimed responsibility for the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist Masoud Ali Mohammadi in Tehran. But under the leadership of Jamshid Sharmat, the group's ugliest attack happened in 2008. The target was a religious place in the southern city of Shiraz, where ordinary people had been holding a mourning ceremony. The attack left 14 dead and more than 200 wounded, including women and children. After the Shiraz attack, the bombers fled to Tehran. They started on their next plan to bomb several locations in the capital city, including Tehran International Book Fair. A successful operation would have been an international tragedy. Since its foundation in 2004, Tondar has been involved in bombings, arson attacks, assassinations, and leaking classified information about the country's defense and security programs. Meanwhile, with the aim of striking terror in the heart of society and pumping money into its terrorist activities, the group has planned again and again to rob banks and currency exchanges inside Iran. This is Jamshid Sharmat, Tondar's ringleader. Although the file is hardly audible, it clearly reveals Sharmat's strategy as a supposedly opposition leader in relation to the nation, indiscriminate killing of civilians, as many as possible. Sharmat has abrasively masterminded and taken responsibility for deadly attacks against his fellow Iranians. If he is not notoriously known in the world like other terrorists such as bin Laden and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, that's only because many of his terrorist plots were foiled by Iran's security before being executed. The list of his terrorist plots goes on and on, from targeting oil pipelines in the south to bombing the Russian consulate in the northern city of Rasht. These are only two examples out of many. In August 2020, Iran's intelligence ministry announced that it had arrested Sharmat following a complex operation and then committed him for trial. Now he has been sentenced to death for a bevy of charges, generally labeled as corruption on earth. In reaction, some other opposition figures such as Masih Ali Nejad, whom herself is reportedly on the CIA pay list, have condemned the sentence. After all, she is regarded inside the country as an American lackey commissioned to instigate disturbances with the final aim of so-called regime change in Tehran. Supporting a terrorist like Sharmat could reveal, to a great extent, her true colors. Meanwhile, Germany has questioned and condemned the sentence, and as a result, expelled two Iranian diplomats. But the fact is, pigeonholing such trials as sham or unfair is an old technique used by the West to protect their own terrorists to the last moment, and at the same time exonerating themselves from harboring terrorists. In other words, if the Germans accept the charges against Sharmat, it means they have accepted harboring a dangerous terrorist on their soil. That's why they're acting like this. But isn't it time for the West to cease financing and harboring terrorists? From their safe havens in the U.S. and Europe, dangerous criminals such as Jamshid Sharmat promote hatred, organize murder and mayhem, and shamelessly claim responsibility for the murder of innocent Iranian civilians. Enough is enough.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. oil and gas industry spent $124.4 million lobbying amid record profits in 2022. The industry targeted rules governing methane emissions as well as oil and gas development on federal lands and waters. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Throughout wrote in this regard, the U.S. oil and gas industry spent about $124.4 million lobbying the federal government in 2022, according to an open secrets analysis of lobbying disclosures. The industry's 2022 lobbying spending is a nominal increase from 2021, but down slightly from adjusted for inflation. Industry-wide spending on lobbying dipped during the COVID-19 pandemic, but increased gradually as fossil fuel companies sought to influence federal action on climate change. Lobbying disclosures indicate the industry targeted a range of issues that will impact oil and gas companies as the global economy weans itself off fossil fuels, including rules governing methane emissions, oil and gas development on federal land and waters, and subsidies for carbon capture technology. Koch Industries, the country's second largest privately held company, also spent about $11.3 million, more than any other oil and gas company, half a dozen other fossil fuel corporations, including Occidental Petroleum, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Chevron Corp, spent another $44.3 million on lobbying. In addition to being among the industry's top lobbying spenders, Occidental Petroleum, Chevron, and ExxonMobil were also among the top emitters of methane and other greenhouse gases in the U.S. in 2022, according to a Cities and Clean Air Task Force report. As Russia-Ukraine crisis transformed the global fossil fuel supply chain, driving oil and gas prices to unprecedented levels, the industry's top lobbying spenders reported record annual profits. Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Exxon and Shell saw a combined $1 trillion in sales in 2022, 15% of which were profits. In June last year, Democratic President Joe Biden singled out Exxon, which reported a record $55 billion in profits for making more money than God. Industry groups also topped the list of 2022 lobbying spenders. The American Petroleum Institute, which represents nearly 600 oil and gas companies, spent about $4.4 million on federal lobbying. The American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers spent about $3.8 million. The combined lobbying, political contribution, and advertising efforts of trade groups opposed to climate change legislations outspent climate advocacy groups by 27-1 between 2008 and 2018, a recent Pennsylvania Capital Star analysis found. These groups have historically contributed to GOP candidates and political committees, with the trend continuing during 2022 cycle. Chevron told Open Secrets, "Our goal is to help shape effective, responsible, and nonpartisan U.S. energy policy in what they said is an effort to deliver affordable, reliable, and ever cleaner energy." The American Petroleum Institute said they regularly engage with a broad range of stakeholders on the critical role U.S. natural gas and oil can play in providing affordable, reliable energy to meet growing global demand while advancing a lower carbon future. Other top industry lobbies, corporations, and groups did not respond to a request for a comment. Last year's most lobbied congressional bill by the oil and gas industry and all other industries was the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, the nation's largest climate spending package ever. The landmark bill, which Biden signed into law on August 16, 2022, directs billions of dollars, including tax incentives, into clean energy technology in an effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Department of Energy posits that the provisions of this bill, combined with the bipartisan infrastructure law of 2021, could reduce emissions by approximately a gigaton. But several provisions in the law also address some of the fossil fuel industry's top priorities. The Inflation Reduction Act requires the federal government to auction offshore leases to oil and gas companies before issuing permits to offshore wind and solar projects. The trade-off was incorporated into law as part of Senate Democratic leadership's deal with Joe Manchin, a swing vote in the Senate. Manchin received over $950,000 from the oil and gas industry over the past 5 years, according to Open Secrets records, and has ties to a family coal business. Oil and gas companies also lobbied for regulatory approval of specific larger-scale projects, which can take years to move forward. ConocoPhillips spent almost $8.7 lobbying the federal government in 2022, up from $4.4 million in 2021, and more than it spent on lobbying in any other year since 2011. Among the issues mentioned in lobbying disclosures was Willow, the company's massive project to extract oil from the federally administered National Petroleum Reserve in the Alaskan Arctic. Environmental groups have urged Biden to block that development permanently, arguing that the project will commit the U.S. to 30 years of fossil fuel extraction and undermine the president's climate agenda. The website of oil price also noted when adjusted for inflation, the oil and gas industries spent on lobbying the federal government last year dipped slightly. In actual terms, oil and gas industry spent $124.4 million on federal lobbying, according to an open secret analysis that was released recently. Of that $124.4 million, Koch Industries spent $11.29 million more than any other oil and gas industry, the records show. In real terms, 2022 spend is up slightly from 2021, but 2021 lobbying spend was still depressed from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the community and most importantly, the people. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues pertaining to India's economy and the Kashmir situation. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss public procurement as part of a free trade agreement of India with different countries. And we shall also take a look at, contrary to the BJP claims, deterioration in the economic and security state of Jammu and Kashmir.
A free trade agreement pact signed between India and the UAE last year has set alarm bells ringing for the big Indian companies. Being India's third largest trading partner, New Delhi last year opened UAE's access to India's public procurement market, displaying a major shift in its trade policy stance. Exports benefiting from the India-UAE free trade pact accounted for about 60% of New Delhi's total non-oil shipments to Abu Dhabi in the December quarter last year.
The India-UAE Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement aims to increase bilateral trade to $100 billion from the current $60 billion in the next 5 years. The UAE is currently the third largest trading partner of India and second largest export destination. After keeping the public procurement market out of FTAs for a long time, India recently opened up access to public tenders over $2 billion to foreign companies as part of the negotiations. Big Indian business houses now face the challenge of foreign competition in acquiring government contracts as Delhi has extended national treatment to the UAE companies. Experts say that maintaining the $2 billion limit will safeguard small and medium-sized industries from the pressure of foreign competition.
We see basically moves that are playing out, which seem to be calculated to give a fundamental business advantage to Atlantic world corporations, which are no longer able to compete with emerging economies. So when these deals are done, It's basically kowtowing again to Uncle Sam and the British and the French and for that matter.